Welcome to Highly Questionable. We got Izzy Gutierrez. It looks like his house, and it's kind of his house, but that's just a background. We got Dominique Foxworth live from New York, and me at a house I'm swimming in cardboard in. Let's go.
Did Giannis's performance last night change what you think will happen in this series?
Man, so first of all, few of us thought that Giannis was actually going to play in this series. Dominique Foxworth thought he was, and he was correct. But the last thing, and I don't even think Dominique expected this, was that he'd be out there looking like healthy, looking as good as we have seen him look. And he put up another 40-burger last night. This is after putting up one in Game 2, and in Game 2, he had the 30-point second half. So much of this postseason has been about what Giannis does not do well, and the free throws immediately jump out because they're so staggering, such a solitary experience, everything else. But this has been your reminder. This is one of the five best players in the NBA, and even before Game 3, the issue with the Bucks wasn't about what happened when Giannis played. It was what happened when he did not play, when they were, I believe, at negative 27 with him off the floor in the course of those first two games. No, this, I don't know if this has changed the way that I think it's going to go based on him and the way that he played. Because, yes, if he plays at this level, then, yeah, the Bucks are going to be really, really, really hard to beat. What I think it has been, though, for most people is a reminder. This dude wasn't smoking mirrors. He wasn't just some regular season phenomenon. He is that dude, and he is carrying the Bucks in a way that we rarely see any player carry any team in the postseason.
Yeah, I expected him to play. You're right. I did not expect to see this. And the point about Giannis being amazing throughout the entire game is one that we pretend like doesn't matter because we are so hyper-focused on those last closing minutes. But the Shaq comparison keeps coming up. And this morning on Get Up, Cassidy Hubbard said to me that Giannis had to make a decision if he was going to be more like Kobe or more like Shaq. And once he's decided to attack the basket in a more Shaq-like manner, he's been more impressive. But I was just blown away by the idea that he had a choice to make. And he is out there playing in a way that shows that even that that's something that could even be considered. And yes, it changed the way I thought about how this series is going to go, because now I feel like potentially they have a chance when before I thought that they didn't. But I still think that the Suns are going to win this because they're more multiple on offense. They feel like more of a complete team that can attack you 15 different ways from the pick and roll with Chris Paul. They can isolate Devin Booker to create offense. And even it seemed like they had some face up ISO game with DeAndre Ayton when he's not in foul trouble. That offensive flexibility and this depth, I don't know if we can call it depth, but it's relative depth that they have on their bench compared to what you're seeing on the other side. Like, that still makes me think that this one game is not going to be defining of this series. We're more likely to see Chris Paul and the Suns pull it out.
I disagree. I had the Bucks in seven, and that was only because I didn't think Giannis was going to play in Game 1. Otherwise, I would have gone with Bucks in five or six, because I felt like they could defend this team. I felt like they could defend Devin Booker and Chris Paul. And so far, we have one game of evidence of that, but it was the most recent one. And I do think that they can continue that. But going back to Giannis for a second, though, it is really interesting, right? Where we were telling this guy this entire time, hey, this is the way you should play. You have a physical advantage in there. Just lift yourself up off the ground and put that ball in the basket. It seems like now, because his knee is balky and he can't do everything that he did before, that it's given him less of an option, and he has to do that, and he's more willing to do that now than he was before. I don't know if he had to sort of have a conversation with himself about, hey, I'm going to plant myself down there, and it doesn't matter how many free throws I shoot or miss, I'm going to keep doing that. He just so happens to have gotten himself into a rhythm between the last couple of games, especially in this game at the free throw line, where there's no reason he should shy away from the paint anymore for the rest of this series, frankly, for the rest of his career, because he can make those free throws. So that's the one thing that stood out is, hey, I'm the centerpiece of this team. It's not a Kobe Shaq thing. Chris Middleton can be Kobe at times, maybe for a couple of minutes, but it is not a Kobe Shaq thing. It is a Shaq thing. He is the man, and everything has to revolve around him. You got a good Jrue Holiday game last night. I don't know if you're going to be able to get a few more of those, because that dude has to be dog tired from picking people up full court this entire season, okay? So, yes, he did a good job on Chris Paul, but he might slip up a little bit in these next couple of games. It all has to be about Giannis giving you that essentially 40 and 15 and a few assists, and see if other guys can fill in those spots. I think they can do that. I think defensively they're more like a Game 3 defensive team than they were in Games 1 and 2, so I think the Bucks have quote-unquote figured something out and are going to win this series.
Well, I think two things, right? So on Giannis in the paint, let's not pretend as though teams weren't out here specifically trying to stop that, right? Like against the Nets in particular, a whole lot of those jumpers came because they were just like, yo, you can have these. And he figured out now how to get it done in the paint. But the Jrue Holiday thing becomes interesting because Budenholzer finally made an adjustment, it seems, and that adjustment was Jrue Holiday, do whatever you got to do to try to slow down Chris Paul. How was that ever the adjustment? How was that ever not the thing that you walked out the door trying to do? Like, I don't want to feel like the guy that's just always looking for a reason to criticize him, even when he gets something right. I just don't understand how that was not plan one from the very beginning. And I love the line that Holiday had after the game when they asked about guarding Chris Paul, or he said, one of us is going to have to be tired. One of us.
How big a deal is it that Team USA lost to Nigeria?
Oh, we're going to start doing this already, huh? USA basketball is probably the most dominant international outfit that we have as a country, right? Like, we go, we whoop behind all over the world. And if they lose a game by 1 point, by 2 point, we tear down the whole program. Well, this time, before we got to the Olympics, they lost 90-87 to Nigeria, a team that's got a whole lot of pros and guys that, for purposes of this competition, been playing together longer than the Olympic team that we've got that's only really been together for a week, right? I don't think this is the biggest thing in the world, and it helps a great deal, of course, again, that the Nigerian teams had more time together, right? What I'm afraid of is people have some understanding of the circumstances of what's going on here. And let us not do this thing that we do with Team USA, which is when they win, we just expect it and we don't get any happiness out of it. If they lose, we tear everybody down that's associated with it. Somehow, we have no pride in our basketball teams in this country, derive no joy from them, even though these guys have given more joy to us than anybody who's going to go to the Olympics.
Not only does Nigeria have NBA-level talent, they have an NBA head coach in there in Mike Brown, right? So this is not only a team that's familiar, it's just another sign that the world has caught up, and it could be any country in any random year that can say, hey, come up and bite Team USA. You've got three guys on this team in Kezia Okpala, Gabe Vincent, and Precious Achiuwa, who not only have been together longer because they trained with Nigeria longer than the Team USA team trained together, they were on the Miami Heat together. They were on the second and third units together. So there is that camaraderie there. Things have changed so much that a guy can get hot against you and hit very difficult shots against pretty decent defense, and you're just like, man, this is a shorter game. We're going to have to hustle to keep up with these guys. So no, I don't think it's the biggest deal in the world. Yes, if they have more time together, they're going to beat even those teams that have NBA-level talent on it. But yeah, you're right, Bo. This isn't some sort of indictment. This isn't something that says, hey, let's all like look at them like real seriously going into the Olympics and say, you better win or we're all just, you don't come back over. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's a little bit of an overreaction to do this during an exhibition game.
I've never wished that this was First Take more in my life, because two guys who are very smart and I agree with most of the time are so wrong about this. I do agree with the idea that it's not a big deal. They're going to be fine. But y'all talking about the world caught up. You didn't say this, Bomani, but I heard Izzy say the rest of the world caught up. And then he named three NBA players that nobody who doesn't cover basketball knew was in the NBA. Y'all need to stop it. And to your point, Bo, about us not getting anything out of this, like, I agree with you, and that's not appreciating how great they are, but that's kind of how it works. As someone who has done lots of exceptional things, people expect you to do exceptional things. And then they're like shocked and disappointed because that's the expectation that you created. They are a team that is full of all-stars and a few Hall of Famers playing against a bunch of people that might, one of the teams, a couple of the teams might have two or three NBA starters, maybe a couple NBA all-stars throughout the tournament. Yes, I expect them to blow everybody out. And when they do, I'm going to be like, yeah, good job. That's right. And if they lose, I'm going to be shocked because they're that much better than everybody else. I'm sorry. I can't pretend that there's going to be some major achievement to destroy the rest of the world in basketball, because that's what we do all the time. I can't fabricate that enthusiasm. Maybe you can, Bo, but I can't.
But the thing is, this team is not the 1992 team where you could argue that that was like at the very least 12 of like the 15 best players in the NBA. That's not who we're putting out there. Like, I'd say the only two guys on this roster right now who are top 10 players on the NBA are Damian Lillard and Kevin Durant. After that, you just kind of got some really good players, because this is a weird year to be trying to go through and to have the Olympics. Like, I think they're going to win the gold medal. I'm just saying, these are not optimal circumstances that we are dealing with. And to the point that you just made, hey, man, we tend to dominate in gymnastics, right? But if they win a silver medal in the team all around in gymnastics, ain't nobody going to be mad and talk about what a terrible disappointment they are. Okay. We're one of the few countries where people got all this time to just spend all day long swimming and not doing anything else. Therefore, we dominated that. If somebody doesn't win there, we ain't going to be like looking at them like, what's wrong? Katie Ledecky get a silver. Nobody's going to be out here raking her over the coals. If these dudes come out here and get a silver, baby, it is going to be smoke in the city. And that's not good for anybody.
Does Gareth Southgate deserve blame for England's penalty disaster?
Okay, I got a buddy named Justin Bowman. He used to work on this show. He is from England, but he roots for the Netherlands in soccer. But he's the man who taught me the phrase, park the bus. For those of you who don't really watch soccer, that is, you get a lead, and since scoring is so hard, you just stop trying and play a whole lot of defense. And that's what England did when they went up 1-0. They say nil. Early, and they parked that bus, and then they gave up one late, and then they lost in penalty kicks. So is that the coach's fault? Probably so. Yes, it is, right? You ain't have to do it like that. You didn't have to play it like that. I don't know if they say this in England, but we got a phrase in the United States, scared money don't make money. Scared money messed around and got them beat in that game. So yeah, we will go ahead and blame this man I had never heard of about the results in this soccer match that, duh, I did not watch.
I watched the match, and I appreciate the honesty. I enjoyed the match, but that is the right thing if you're going to criticize the manager in this situation. Because I think a lot of the criticism of the manager is going with a couple of late substitutions in order to have the right guys on the pitch to kick the penalties. And the criticism there is they didn't have time to warm up. But I'm a football guy. Like, that's what we do to kickers all the time. You don't do anything. You just go in and kick. So, like, it feels to me like you're doing too much if you want to criticize the coach for putting some cold guys in to do penalties. Those are offensive-minded players who know how to kick footballs. Put them in the game, kick it in at the cage, at least make them save it and don't put it off the post. Like, that to me is not fair to criticize, to be critical of the manager in that situation. But your point about getting the early goal and then essentially giving up trying to play the four corners offense for the rest of the game, that's a fair criticism.
But this is where being at home definitely hurt them, because this is a Chicago Cubs in the World Series situation. This is the old Curse of the Bambino situation. There is a lot of pressure for England to bring this cup home, and they're doing it in front of their fans. And you're bringing in guys who hadn't played, and the last one was 19 years old. He wasn't even alive the last when this whole thing started about England needing to bring this stuff home, and here he was, all on him. That was entirely unfair. And like I said, Southgate had a really good tournament, made all the right decisions, pressed all the right buttons until the very end, and the Italians just took it from you. It has to be absolutely heartbreaking for that country, and then of course, predictable, they went the racist route and started, you know, hating on the guys who missed it. And it's just like, man, how things can go from 2 minutes into this tournament to just giving everything that's ugly about this sport in that country all in the frame of like 2.5 hours. That is absolutely nuts. But that's how crazy soccer is in Europe, but specifically in England, where they want to bring it home so badly.
Yeah, there's a certain irony to the people in England being mad at the black people for messing something up for their country, right? Like, I think those of us who know history would appreciate that that's a little bit kind of backwards in a way. But is England, as someone who doesn't follow this that close, are they like the Knicks of soccer in the sense that, like, Knicks fans got their minds right this year because they were just happy to get what they got? But I feel like a country that hadn't won the World Cup since 1950, right? But I think they invented the soccer and all this stuff. They sure got high expectations of themselves, and they need to be really happy for the fact that they got there in the first damn place, right? Be present in the moment. Take joy in what you got.
Up next on HQ.
You know what the challenge did? It just gave the referees an opportunity to sit at the table and be like, damn! Oh, can we get that from another angle? Oh, no, it wasn't no foul, but oh, can we see that?
Time to play the game that really, 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 really missed Izzy during his vacation. Do your question.
Oh, Izzy was gone? Worked. Yeah, I didn't know that. Anyway, you give us topics and events and we question them. Welcome back.
Do you question if winning Wimbledon puts Djokovic above Nadal and Federer all time?
All right, I saw somebody make the point on Twitter yesterday, and it was a great one. They had the graphic showing that Federer, Nadal, and Novak Djokovic have 20 majors apiece. That it would basically be like if you put up three quarterbacks and said they all had won 10 championships in the NFL. Like, it is amazing that all these guys are relative contemporaries and have reached these heights. Look at this, though. Look at him return this crazy forehand from Berrettini. Berrettini hits forehands at 100 miles an hour.
That's
it. I mean, it's easy to understand.
Look at this. Look at this. This is incredible. I already forgot what the question was. I think it was something about being like the greatest player of all time. And I honestly have no idea how you're supposed to make a decision between those three guys about which one is the greatest of all time. Like before, my thought was Federer was greater than all of them, but Nadal had that head-to-head. And I think that we can overstate that, but I understand why people then did it. And now there's been this charge from Djokovic, who looks like he's got the Novak slam. It looks like he's about to get the single year Grand Slam going. And if he does do that, he's got a strong case for being the greatest of all time, while Pete Sampras sits at the back like, dog, has it been that long? Have you completely forgotten about me?
I know Dominique has a lot on this subject, so I'm going to get in and get out real quick. Look, that's 20, right? And the other guys, look, I do believe that he is probably going to lose to like prime Roger Federer if you can somehow back up the clock and have them play against each other. But the way I look at it is Federer and Nadal are like Larry and Magic. They came in, they dominated the league, they were the best of the best, and Djokovic kind of overlaps some. He's Jordan. He's the guy that's going to take over from there. He'll definitely be the GOAT, you know, 2 or 3 years from now when he collects 4 or 5 more of these things.
We got the Olympics coming too, right? I don't think we mentioned that. Like, the potential that he could put some more hardware on his mantle this year. But I think you made the perfect analogy. I was trying to think of it the whole way through because, as you have already pointed out, I may not be the biggest tennis guy. So I'm thinking about how it crosses over to other sports. And you're right. Sometimes we need to think about these as entertainment properties. And when we watch great movies or great TV shows, there's one character that we love and we care about. And I know we think more is always better, but sometimes it's better just to have that dude. And we're seeing that in the NBA Finals this year, and we're also appreciating that in what we're getting from tennis right now.
Do you question if this was almost a good defensive play from PJ Tucker?
All right, man, I remember when Cam Johnson got drafted. He was 23 years old. He had, you know, done 5 years in college, and all of us were like, wow, that seemed to be really early to take Cam Johnson. Kobe White, his teammate, was stunned that he was taken that early in the draft. And apparently James Jones, the GM of the Suns, is a genius. Look at this. PJ Tucker was like, okay, cool. I don't really got nothing to worry about here, right? Yes, you do. Right? Like, he got himself outside the circle, and it made it worse. Put a knee in his shoulder. Kept going. And so Tucker's on the ground after this, just stunned. Can't believe it happened. And the Bucks couldn't believe it either. They're like, we're going to challenge this. And you know what the challenge did? It just gave the referees an opportunity to sit at the table and be like, damn! Oh, can we get that from another angle? Oh, no, it wasn't no foul. But, oh, can we see that? Oh, can we see that?
He had like an 8-minute stretch there where he was the best player in the NBA. It seemed like he couldn't miss in that stretch right there. And so it feels kind of like showing this dunk over and over again, even though they lost this game. It feels like it's kind of unfair to PJ Tucker, but it's even more unfair to Cam Johnson because he was out there cooking.
Whatever, show it again. PJ is going to have to live with this one, right? Like, I feel like for PJ, like, if you were going to stop this, you need to stop it with your shoulder. You know what I'm saying? You needed to be a bit more proactive in trying to stop this. Cam Johnson decided at the antlers that this was the move that he was going to make.
Little nugget on James Jones, by the way, Bomani, who you labeled a genius. Well, James Jones and I went to the same gifted program in elementary school, Sable Palm Elementary. So if he's a genius, Time to play the game that really, really, really only missed Dominique during my vacation. See or no?
Fine. You tell us what's on TV tonight, we tell you if we're intrigued.
Tonight on ESPN, the 2021 Home Run Derby.
Yo, I'm generally not into the Home Run Derby. I mean, it's really batting practice, but man, they got some dudes in there, and they got this dude, Shohei Ohtani. This is his 33rd home run right here. Look at this. This is 460 feet.
Oh, wow. Where did that one go?
We talk about this stuff all the time on this show, and I don't want to pretend as though nobody's talking about this. But this still feels like what he's doing is far more incredible than we're giving it any credit for being. A top-notch starting pitcher, and then he does stuff like this. Izzy, are you intrigued?
I'm very intrigued by America's leanest bacon, by the way. I'm going to Google that after the show. Absolutely intrigued. Anytime you can get Ohtani on a stage right now, because we don't know how much longer he's going to be able to do this. Hopefully it's for a really long time. But right now, we know that the Angels aren't going to put him on a big stage because they're, you know, middle of the pack. They're a 500 team right now. They're not quite as big a losers as we remember them being, but compared to how good Ohtani is, yeah, they're kind of keeping the floor pretty low here. So yeah, I'm intrigued for him, and I wish he were on another team. There, I said it.
Don't you worry. They'll be a loser one way or another. It's just what they do. Dominique, are you intrigued?
Absolutely, I'm intrigued. The home run derby is normally something that I do kind of enjoy, but I'm especially going to enjoy it this year with Ohtani in it. And it's kind of amazing because I think about this in other sports. We don't have a pitching display like we have in like basketball. You have the 3-point contest and a dunk contest. Like, how amazing would it be to have somebody win them both in one year? They need some sort of pitching display so Ohtani can do both at this outing. So I guess maybe he'll go out and strike out a few people in the All-Star game, but it's not quite the same as if they had some sort of movement contest. Obviously, you can't have people throw it as hard as they can, but we need to fully appreciate Ohtani. He has to pitch it to himself or something to give us a way to appreciate how amazing it is that he can do both.
All right, that is our show. I normally tell you what these other guys are going to be up to, but right now, I don't even really know, to be honest with you. But we do TV. We be on this channel. Check us out.
You know exactly what I'm up to.
Crossword Fridays.
There you go.